Good morning. This is Tracy Hales Vass, right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM. This morning, I'm talking to Bruce Wilson about his historical fiction, Death in the Black Patch. Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, good morning, Tracy.
I have to say I really enjoyed Death in the Black Patch. I learned a lot, and it was really well written. It kept my attention through the whole thing. So this is historical fiction, but it's real personal history, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's based on true events that happened in the life of my great-grandfather and his family back in 1906 in Kentucky.
Give the audience a little bit of a synopsis then, so they'll know what we're talking about.
Sure. It's a story of my great-grandfather, Wes Wilson, and his wife, Zora. They were tobacco farmers in western Kentucky, and it was at the time when James B. Duke of the American Tobacco Company had gained a monopoly in buying tobacco in America. So he had started to drive the prices he was paying for this tobacco down below the cost to produce the product. And so we ended up with a group of farmers who were sort of caught in the middle between this greedy tobacco company and then a number of farmers who were organizing into an association with the intent of holding their tobacco out and not selling it. And so my great-grandfather was one of those folks caught in the middle. He could sell his tobacco to the company, get cash money, pay his mortgage, but in the process lose his family and friends for being a, what they called at the time, a hillbilly. And he could then instead join up with the association and hold back his tobacco, get no money, and then ultimately lose his farm. So the synopsis from that point on basically is, here's my great-grandfather, Wes Wilson, stuck in the middle trying to make a decision, and he's doing this with family secrets and lies, pride, and a whole lot of moonshine getting in the way of his decision.
Yeah, I love the families. Each family you fleshed out very realistically, and I got quite attached to them. Did you know your great-grandmother Zora?
No, she actually lived until the year I graduated from high school, but we never traveled. We were a large family and didn't get to take vacations, and she lived back in Kentucky, so I never got to meet her. Obviously, I didn't get to meet a lot of those folks because they died before
right.
I was born. All of the family that I've represented in the book, Wes and Zora and their children, the brother and his wife who lived next door, the brother who owned the store, all of those folks were real. I did have to make a few changes, especially when the names were similar. The brother Mark, who owned the general store, his wife's name was really Lula, which is very similar to Wes's daughter Mary Lula.
Right.
So I gave her a fictional name, but it was interesting writing about family. I had to do a lot of creative work to imagine what my ancestors were like.
Well, you really captured it, as well as the setting and the foods and the chores and the smells and that time of life in rural Kentucky became very real in the book.
Well, I tried extra hard to do that. Being a history professor, I'm pretty good at watching for the specifics and avoiding anachronisms. For instance, in trying to come up with the character of my great-grandfather, I looked first at my own dad, and I knew that he had some issues relative to drinking and pride. The same thing for my grandfather, his father. They also dealt with the same kinds of issues, so it was pretty easy to project that back into Wes. The others, it just tried to match them up to family members. One of the characters, it sounds a lot like my youngest brother. And I think I found myself in one of the other characters. I won't tell you which one.
But. Okay.
So it was that the scenery and the weather and everything. I did a lot of research in Kentucky, several trips back there, actually walked in the dirt of the place where my great-grandfather's farm was. The roads were the same. There was not a whole lot of modern buildup.
Wow.
Sure, there were power lines and things like that and gas stations. But Linville, Kentucky in 2006, the first time I went there, was not a whole lot different than what it was in 1906. In fact, it was probably smaller by then.
Yeah, it was a very small town. Everybody gathered at Mark's store to drink coffee and gossip.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So your grandfather was Anthy.
Yes, that's correct.
He was a troubled boy.
He was, and I think I gave it to him as a boy because that's how I knew him, as my father described him as an adult. Now, it's a lot different than the man I knew as my grandfather in the 60s, 50s and 60s in where I lived in California. But Anthy at that time was the one of the family who just never did want to be a farmer. He never ended up being a farmer. I think in my author's notes at the end of the book, I talk about how he went on to be an itinerant barber after spending some time in the Army and, marrying Sudie and then being not married to Sudie and then getting remarried to Sudie, all within the course of a few years.
Wow.
So he and Sudie had 7 boys.
Oh, my.
In the course of about 10 years in 4 or 5 different states.
So now you'll have to write Anthy's story.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I a lot of folks who are not part of the family suggested that I do that because he and Sudie obviously had an adventure. But writing about family is tough.
I bet it
is.
Because
when I did the first book launch of this back in 2016 in Kentucky, in Mayfield, the county seat, I was not anticipating a lot of people showing up. Had done an article the week before in the local newspaper, the Mayfield Messenger, and I was surprised when my wife Mary and I walked into the library where the book launch was going to take place, and I had about 50 cousins sitting there.
Oh, my.
Second cousin, twice removed, that sort of thing. And they all had stories, and they all had pictures of some of these real folks. So it was, that was an adventure. I've decided instead to write a book about one of the fictional characters in the book.
And is that the next one, Ain't No Place That Far?
Yes, and I've kind of changed the title to No Place That Far. My wife thought that ain't, coming from an English professor didn't sound right. So it's called No Place That Far, and the character in the book, J.D. Hooper, one of the Knight Riders, one of the bad characters in there, is my protagonist in No Place That Far.
Oh, so we see J.D. again.
Yes, you do. A lot of him, and he's still nasty.
He is one of those characters that you love to hate.
Exactly. And the hard part was trying to find, some kind of redeeming value. You got to have something that you like about the protagonist.
Right.
And I think I found something, and it's something that he doesn't particularly like about himself, but it's not something that he can change. So that's part of the conflict he faces.
Sounds
the other
intriguing.
Thing I've tried to do with that book is make it easier for me to sell it by moving him down to the Southwest. A lot of my book sales and all my marketing efforts were in Kentucky and Tennessee. And I did some things in Albuquerque, of course, but this time I'm going to have him come from Kentucky, end up for some time in El Paso, and then end up over in southern Arizona. So there's some traveling to be done and a lot of trouble to get into 19th into the 20th.
Oh, but then you've got him here at home.
Yeah, I can go places and drive there instead of having to get on an airplane.
Exactly. Well, I look forward to that. When will that be coming out?
I'm about two-thirds to three-quarters finished with the first draft. I hope to have it in my publisher's hands before next spring. You know the process. My first book, it took me 10 months writing every day to get the first draft of that book, some 130,000 words, and then I let it sit for 2.5 months. Which was hard to do at first.
Right.
And then I started the rewrites, and I did a total of 4 or 5 rewrites, including working with a group of beta readers, folks that I trusted. But from the first day I started writing it till the day my publisher had it in his hands was 2 years.
That's pretty quick turnaround.
It was very quick. And to get a traditional publisher, too, and not have to self-publish, although I was willing to do whatever it took to get the story out.
Yeah.
I would hope to have continued writing at the same time I was doing all the marketing for Death and the Black Patch, but that took trips and book clubs and library events. The Tucson Festival of Books, a couple years back, I was standing out on the corner of where the publisher's tent was, and I was basically promoting it by standing out there with books in hand, asking people if they wanted to meet a famous writer. And then when they approached me, I said, well, I lied about the famous part, but I did write a book,
right.
And I would tell them about it. So it turned out to be a good day. But all of that takes time that I'm not sitting down writing.
And you also are a professor of history. Working
professor
now.
Of history, and I actually teach writing as well, composition for freshman students.
So do you ever sleep?
Oh, sure. It's a nice thing. This is the second career, so it's a lot easier. I spent 35 or more years in corporate America, and when I retired to Silver City, I just went back to school and decided to get my master's degree. Finished that in, 2 years. They asked me to teach before I even walked and got my diploma. I was one of those fortunate ones as a grown-up. I did a whole lot better on my grades than I did as a kid.
Oh, I know those students. Yes, they're the best.
Yeah. So, it was good. So I've enjoyed this second career, really. It's teaching. I'm in classroom 4 days a week. I just love being with those young people, and it keeps me young.
I understand that completely. And as a writing teacher, it's so fun to see those stories come out. Sometimes it's heartbreaking, but
yes,
every once
is.
In a while you really get that gem of a writer.
And it's few and far between, but they are in there. And the ones that you can talk to and work with that get the energy somehow, you're
right.
Able to transmit it from yourself to the student, and that student just gets on fire with the idea of using their imagination, even in their scholarly writing,
that's
gain a voice that they didn't know they had.
Right, to discover it. That's why I loved to teach. So would you like to read a little bit from Death in the Black Patch for our audience?
This takes place, it's about two-thirds of the way into the book, during the difficult second week of the storyline. Wes has just gotten home from having met with his brother Mark and his cousin Art in Mark's store in Linville.
Okay.
And so this farm is a couple of miles away, and he's just gotten home, and Zora is waiting to talk to him. The moon bathed the farmyard in a silvery blue glow, and the cool wind blowing across the fields brought with it the scents of growing crops to the porch where Wes and Zora sat. Around her shoulders, Zora wore a woolen shawl and clutched it close against her throat. Rufus lay at her feet, his head resting on her shoes. The rhythm of his tail as it swished across the porch wood created an exotic harmony with the breeze. Wes sat slumped on the edge of the porch, his feet resting in the scrub grass of the yard. His hands clutched the whiskey jug in his lap while the shotgun lay on the wood next to him. In the hour he'd been home, he hadn't taken a drink. He pulled the cork several times and even lifted the jug to his lips once, but he didn't drink from it. He wanted to take a drink. Oh, Lord, he truly wanted to, but he fought it hard. Despite the quietness of the night, his ears buzzed like an army of crickets. His muscles quivered, vibrated, pulsed with some internal, almost painful energy, and his mind would not rest. Everything that he'd worried about and thought about for the past week fought for his attention. The thoughts wouldn't go away, the voices wouldn't shut up, and they wouldn't let him rest. From deep below the noise, his voice fought to be heard. It sounded like it came from a child, a weary, hurting child. "I'm so tired," it said. "I don't know what to do. I just want to rest." Zora usually enjoyed nights like this when she and Wes could relax after a hard day of working and dealing with the commotion that having six children generated. But on this night, she was not relaxed. She needed to talk to Wes, and even though she knew that pushing him to talk would probably lead to an argument, she decided to take the chance. Wes, what did you talk about at Mark's tonight? Her voice was soft and clear and flat. Wes didn't speak up right away. He knew where his conversation was heading and what it could do to Zora if he lost his temper. He was worn out from the ride and didn't have the energy to wear the mask and pretend. He just couldn't do it anymore. When he turned to face her, the words finally came out. They poured out of him, hot, loud, and full of anger. Damn it, Zora, we talked about tobacco and murder. We talked about sick wives and hurt kids. We talked about how hard it is to make decisions when nothing seems to make any sense and none of the choices we have are any good. You don't know how hard it is to decide between feeding your kids or losing your friends, or deciding between protecting your property against night riders and then losing it when you run out of money. All of that's my job, my responsibility, and I got to think about it all of the damn time. He paused, and his voice, though still angry, softened a little. And I'm so damn tired I can't think anymore. Zora felt pinned to the wall by his angry words. She knew that they were unfair and selfish. She wanted to lash out at him and tell him he was wrong, but didn't want to drive him into doing something like his own father had done. So she swallowed her own bitter anger, and her voice hushed, said, "You're wrong, Wes, about so many things. We're a family, you and me, and we can decide this together." "No, Zora, we can't," said Wes, his pride taking over. "This is my problem. Only I can choose what to do." He stood up, holding the jug in his left hand, and reached down to pick up the shotgun. "Now go on back into the house and leave me alone." She watched as he headed across the yard and into the tobacco field, disappearing in the darkness.
Very poignant.
Yeah, it's still even hard to read.
I bet it is. Well, it's very graphically written so that it puts the reader right there. The moonshine was really a problem for Wes, as it was obviously for several of the people involved in this.
All of this was the times were very difficult. We think today that, you know, we lead stressful lives, and I think a lot of that we just bring on ourselves. You know, cell phones and internet and all of that. And they had very little communication outside of their community. They would deal with the hard part of life every day, eating, sleeping, working 6-7 days a week. You'll find, of course, in this story, they go to church every Sunday, sometimes unwillingly, but they do. That was the only time they had to meet up with other folks. The farms were not very large in most cases, 40 acres, but, you know, stacked up right next to each other. People across the road you might see out in their field, but it would just be a wave. There was just too much time spent working.
And you did include the article in the newspaper the day after the denouement of the book, The mm-hmm. Real Thing. So that was pretty interesting.
And that was how I found out about it in the first place. I did mention at the end of the book how my dad was a storyteller. He was telling us stories as kids, and we liked those. One that he told in particular was the one that led me ultimately to take the trip, my first trip to Linville, and to actually go to the library in Mayfield and to, you know, find that full article of what actually happened. I won't mention it in the interview here because I don't want people to know the end of the book.
Right. We won't give it away.
But it was a real event. It actually happened. I just had to make a story that would get us there.
Right.
Which is a little different than is typical. We may know what we want to tell as we write a story, but we just follow the words until we get there. I knew how it was going to end. I needed then to find a good place to start, and it was with historical research by finding out about the Black Patch War. Mm-hmm. And understanding the conflict that created, and then to create the personal conflict that led ultimately to that tragedy at the end.
I think that's the way it is often with historical fiction, that you know how it ends. Yeah, and it was very believable. I was worried at times that Wes was actually going mad between the moonshine and the stress and the decisions.
And that was interesting, Tracy, because that came to me partway through as I was doing the writing, this idea of madness. or insanity, how substance abuse, how family pressure, how economic pressure can all lead to that sort of thing. And there is the image of the mask that I use. I try not to dwell on it. In fact, I didn't build it into it. It sort of came to me one day how he was all bound up in all of this stuff, and yet his family expected him to be the dad, the husband, and to be in charge and in control at a time when he was losing control internally. So I had him dealing with, I think some of the images I used were demon dogs or something in his thoughts that were just chewing at him all the time.
Right. I think you said they were dogs that turned into demons.
Yes. Those kinds of things come when I'm writing. I never entered into this with the idea of creating, you know, some kind of theme or writing some kind of symbolism into this. It just happened as you write the characters. I think their realness comes out.
So do you feel that you now know your great-grandfather better, or do you feel that Wes in the book is more a conglomeration of other things?
I think, and that, I love that question. I think what it really came to me in this was, this could very well have been Wes Wilson in reality. When I talked to those cousins in Kentucky and they said it sounded so real, it had to be. What you've done is you've created the reality for us. We've never had anybody tell a story of our family, and you've done it, and so now it is the history. And I said, but this is just fiction. It came from my mind. And they said, then it's all we have. We don't have recordings or film of those folks. We don't have anything in writing from those folks. But I explain it in the approach that I took of taking characteristics from my father and his father,
right,
knowing how my grandmother Sudie really was as an older woman, was easy to write her as a young girl, flirtatious, fun, just a gentle soul, because that's the kind of person Sudie was.
Oh, she's very cute.
I didn't know Zora, but I imagine Zora, having seen her pictures, she looks hard and worn out on her whole life, but that was a generational thing as well.
Right.
So
right,
to write her as the foundation, the thing that held the family together. The daughter, Mary Lula, my dad's Aunt Lula, you know, lived into the 1950s, and he talked of her fondly, but I saw her in a special role as the oldest daughter, you know, with an older brother and then four younger siblings, as having taken over some of that stability from her mother.
And she took care of the baby a lot. The baby was often on her lap. And
that would have been, I think, the job for the oldest daughter.
Right. You get a big family like that, that everyone's working. Everybody has a role.
And they all, whatever they would have earned, had there even been any money to earn, but whatever they generated, all stuck with the idea of keeping the family safe and whole.
And they knew it, though some of them
reluctantly did it,
right,
like Anthony did.
Exactly what I was going to say. Anthony didn't like it much. He got the brunt of things a lot.
Yes, he did. Well, especially that first event in, what was it, Chapter 3?
Right.
He pulled a stunt, right?
He did.
Took off with the mule and didn't tell anybody and faced the music when he got back. It was just a lot harsher than he thought.
Right. Because there were so many other things going on, but he didn't even know that.
Right.
It was very real life. Often I think kids are abused because of that kind of a situation.
I was pleased when it was done. I didn't want to quit writing it.
Yes.
When I got to the end, that was the end, I had to quit. And it was difficult, especially when I did my first edit, and I cut out of that first draft, probably 12,000 words of good stuff.
Wow.
I did a chapter on Wes and Zora as young people when they first met. And it was good writing. It was a good story, but it didn't move the story along. So maybe I'll turn it into a short story someday. But writing about that and the family and the intensity of it and doing it, you know, writing something every day for 10 months, 300 and some days, there were days I I could get 1,500 or 2,000 words in a couple of hours of writing. I remember one particular day when I wrote down, I think, about 12 or 15 words, and I didn't even know where they were going to go, but they were words. By keeping at it, I learned I could just pretty soon try to keep up with the story as it came out.
You want to get to that point where the story tells itself.
And those things that will spark in your mind and come to you and say, ooh, ooh. One thing I did on a daily basis, everything I wrote on any particular day, after I got back from teaching, I'd sit down with my wife and I would read to her what I wrote. And she would come up with ideas and suggestions along the way. And those things I made notes of. And so that story was able to stay alive every day with a reader, even though she listened to me read it. And so I found that following of the story, letting it take its own life, worked very well. And I remember the last couple of days that I was writing that first draft, and I knew I was getting close. And I had already thought about how to stage that last event. And I knew that there was going to be a final epilogue kind of a chapter, the results of that tragedy. But I had to stage it out much like a director for a play.
Oh, of course.
And I've done some acting, and I staged things, and so I had to think, how am I going to move these folks around to do what they have to do to end up like the newspaper article said? So I wrote that, and then I'd already sort of drafted that final chapter that takes place out at the cemetery. So I just kind of cleaned that up on this day, and I looked at it, and I said, I'm done.
Wow.
I caught up at the right time, but it just hit me that this was it, that I had nothing more really to write based on that first draft.
So at your writing process, you knew the time period, I mean, as far as the two-week period that you wrote every day, you knew the culminating end. So did you just figure out when to start and write to that, or did you outline?
My general outlines were just blocks of story.
Okay.
I didn't use Roman numeral capital letters or anything like that. I just started writing, and then I'd say, I need to write something for this. There were times when I thought, I don't need to write about this whole day because it's nothing necessarily feeding the story would have to have happened. So you'll find by my chapters being days and dates, there are some skips in there.
Right.
And those it was hard at first. I felt like I needed to fill every day with something. And then after a while, I thought, I really didn't, that it was just going to drag for the reader, and I didn't want that. And, of course, Mary, my wife, would point those things out. This is too slow. You don't need this. That's hard for a first-time novelist to say that somebody doesn't want them to write something. Learning to listen to her and to listen to her ideas as being all she truly wanted, that she wasn't insisting on a change or insisting on anything other than just hear me. And I learned to listen. It really paid off, I think, in the quality of what turned out. And evidently, some folks thought my book really was good. My reviews early on were pretty nice. I had a newspaper writer in Louisville, Kentucky, who read it and actually put it on a March must-read thing for 2017. And to win a couple of prizes, like a finalist in the New Mexico Arizona Book Awards, or to win the Laramie Book Award for Western Fiction, even though it was Western Kentucky, competing against people writing, pioneers and cowboys, right, and things like that.
Yeah, it is very well written. I was very impressed, and I appreciate the opportunity to interview you.
Yeah, I guess mostly just I hope people enjoy the book. If they buy it, that's good. If somebody loans it to them, that's okay too. I obviously, Jeff Habiger, my publisher, would like me to sell everything. But for me, it was the story that had to be out there. I'm just glad that people read the story and that the listeners to the program might keep their eyes open for No Place That Far. It is going to come out next year.
Great.
And Jeff and I stay in touch. Mm-hmm. And he asked me how I'm making my progress. So I love doing what I do. I love teaching. I love writing. I'm a pretty happy 72-year-old guy who feels like he's 19 on the inside.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate talking to you.
Ed. Thank you, Tracy.
This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington.